Captain James Cook, Above the waterline, with two more decks above. small cocktail party toward the end of the trip. It's like living in an 8-story condominium without an elevator. They wondered where the officer whose cabin this was bunking. There were 109 passengers in all, a League of Nations, 19 states, 10 countries represented. Open seating in the dining room at lectures and other activities, plenty of opportunity to mix and get acquainted. A complete machine shop is manned by a skilled crew capable of doing everything from changing light bulbs to major repairs at sea. Extra propellers secured on decks can be changed in 2 or 3 days at sea. It's never been necessary on the Yamal, and only one time on a sister ship, cracked due to faulty casting. First morning, a compulsory abandoned ship drill efficiently handled. Survival gear aboard is sufficient for 2 weeks. The open seating mixed passengers, Japanese, Taiwanese, Germans, Swiss, Tahitians, and Canadians, as well as Americans. But Ed drew special attention. North Sea routes open year-round. The Yamal is the newest and one of the most sophisticated and powerful vessels in the world. Its displacement is 23,000 tons with a 75,000-horsepower nuclear engine driving 3 propellers. A 20-inch-thick bow is built for breaking through ice. Its nuclear fuel requires replacing only once in 5 years. Its open water speed reaches 22 knots, and it has broken through a record 27 feet of ice. The Yamal carries 2 Russian-built helicopters, a large Mi-2 and a smaller Ka-32. They're used for scouting the ice ahead, for liaison with ships being escorted, and for shuttling passengers from ship to shore. The Yamal carries a skillful crew of 150. The Arctic has challenged explorers, entrepreneurs, the foolish, the brave. Many died, others were shipwrecked, frozen, or starved. Yet today, curious travelers like the Balls can make the voyage in relative comfort. They headed ever northward. Second day out, they sighted first ice. We'll see plenty of it as the voyage continues. The first polar bears appeared in the distance. Great excitement. Passengers were divided into 7 groups, approximately 12 in each, to prevent congestion at the helicopter pad. The big doctor's blast is equivalent to a 70-mile-an-hour. They learned about climbing in and out safely. They learned to turn their backs to the helicopter after depriving and kneeling to prevent being blown over. The first time, several were blasted to the ground, or into a convenient snowbank like that. No one hurt. Everyone learned fast. The Zodiacs were never used throughout the voyage. First stop, Victoria Island, claimed by Canada, an abandoned weather station, seldom visited. dioxide, not discovered until 1897. It was the first helicopter ship-to-shore experience. Next was the Franz Josef Archipelago. Picture was told of early explorers who'd gone before, through trials, hardships, even deaths. Why did they do it? Some were whalers, but many were explorers, because it was there to be first to reach the pole by whatever means. Knowledgeable and articulate lecturers told the dramatic, often tragic stories, histories, and legends of the islands.
I made three trips to the nuclear submarines.
Captain Frank McLaren, a retired U.S. Navy, a scientist, and much more, lectured on skippering three nuclear submarines beneath the ice to the North Pole and beyond. He surveyed the entire Siberian continental shelf and the underwater Northwest Passage, possibly for commercial use. He was also under the ice for as long as 2 months at a time. A fascinating and entertaining shipmate, president of the Explorers Club. He arranged a cocktail party for the 18 Explorer Club members in the captain's quarters.
On that land, with the Scottish Polar Research Institute in Cambridge in Britain.
Also lecturing Bob Hedlund, a British historian who explored, studied, and wrote about the polar regions and was decorated for his expeditions. He's a statistician as well. He estimates the number of people who have stood on the North Pole. Those arrived by icebreaker, 2,950. By submarine, surprisingly, 4,272. By aircraft, 958. And by surface, an estimated 60. The grand total as of 12 July 1996, including this group, 8,240. This may seem a rather large number, but he pointed out it's a tiny fraction of the world's population of 5.7 billion, a small group to have had such a privilege.
I'm not sure this scientist.
Dr. Mikhail Groswald was an enthusiastic Russian lecturer on geology, the Arctic seas, and their currents. His specialty was the realm of ice domes and basaltic flat-top mountains. Was a fascinating conversationalist on history and politics in Russia, a bit difficult to understand because of his accent. Another lecturer, Dr. Yar Petrosin, was born of educated Russian parents who were considered enemies of Stalin's communist society. They were imprisoned and died in the Gulag, located on the barren northernmost coast of Siberia at Khabarovka. A brief stop made there to meditate and pay respects to the memory of those who lived and died 60 years ago. Yar, educated in the United States, is now curator of the Museum of Natural History at the University of Arizona. He lectured on global weather, which he theorizes originates in the Kola Sea, spreading southward, spewing storms and bad weather in its wake. Frank Todd, an articulate biologist, lectured on birds and mammals of the Arctic. All lectures were graphically illustrated with photographs, interesting slides, and charts. The days and some nights were fully scheduled and always different. Except for meals, there were no regularly planned events. King Neptune and his strange entourage came aboard as the 80th parallel was crossed. Light drizzle was falling, but not enough to dampen the occasion. There was a barbecue on deck, and all were proclaimed polar bears. Several landings were made on islands in the Franz Josef Archipelago, including Aquilova Island, Cape Norway, and Jackson Island, where Nansen and Johansson wintered in 1895. Nurses at Incredible Story, two men isolated for 7 months in a tiny stone hut, about 10 by 6, in total darkness, a polar bear hide for a roof. How could they possibly have survived? Historic sites abounded, such as Cape Flora, named for its abundance of mosses, lichens, and flowers during the Arctic short summer. It was summertime in the Arctic, temperate, the hardy vegetation taking advantage of the brief season. Early explorers, some of them shipwrecked, ate plants, moss, and flowers. not much nourishment, but a vital source of vitamin C to protect against scurvy. After Island, the captain maneuvered Yamal until its bow almost touched the magnificent Ruby Rock, the salted plug 600 feet tall. Variety of sea birds, primarily black gulls, fulmars, and penguins. The rock's unusual formation provides layers of ledges with thousands of birds' nests safe from predators. They lay their precious eggs, one to a couple, each one shaped so it won't roll off its precarious nest. Parents take turns protecting their egg, providing food for the chick. Among lizards, most of them end up premature falling hundreds of feet to the ocean before it's ready to follow. As the ship nosed almost close enough to touch the formation, the sight, sounds, and smells were almost overwhelming. At Calm Bay are the ruins of the Sedo Meteorological Facility, operated from 1929 to 1963, named after George Sedo, as an explorer who led an expedition in 1912 from his base camp here in the North Pole. He died before reaching home. There's a small memorial to his memory and several unmarked graves. Franz Josef Island, the ship continued its charge northward. Helicopter flights were arranged to drop passengers in the floating ice and ahead of the ship. Scout forward to the Atlantic provided wonderful opportunities to photograph the ship in action. On the 11th, a distinguished visitor was expected. All hands on the bridge, mandatory. As might be expected, the guest was Santa Claus, welcoming all as they approached his traditional home, the North Pole. The great day arrived. Destination, the North Pole, a day earlier than scheduled. After breakfast, Molly Herbert gave an excellent historic lecture, appropriately, the conquest of the North Pole. At 2:45 p.m., the arrival of the North Pole was announced. Several of the passengers with their own proper positioning systems confirmed the destination. The North Pole, 90 degrees latitude, 0 degrees longitude. Head's GPS rep at Muncie was 3,250 nautical miles away. The North Pole lies under a huge island of ice, 6 million square miles of it. Drifts slowly eastward, maybe as much as 2 kilometers a week, so they were not long exactly at the geographical position of the North Pole. The bottom lies some 12,000 feet below. The closest land is Greenland. Nothing anchors this huge ice island to a fixed position. As soon as the captain had located a suitable position in the ice, the gangway was lowered to the ice level. There was a barbecue and several special activities. Among them, Ed's triathlon. Why? Well, the world would come to Muncie on September 7th when athletes from many nations assembled to swim, bicycle, and run in the International Long Course Triathlon. So, as honorary chairman of that event, Ed decided to do his own triathlon at the North Pole, and he established his own world's record.
The day arrived from the North Pole Circumstance Triathlon. One of them, the solar girls, had raised a white collapsible bicycle to be brought down to the ice by some strong emotion. 8 legs before her cabin. Anticipating a plunge into the Arctic Ocean was surreptitiously put on my wetsuit over a pair of long johns and under my outer clothing.
We made our way down to the ice and to a straight pole identified as a North Pole. We walked around it the whole world, all of its time zones and all its longitudes in less than a minute. Objective one for Ed's North Pole triathlon was accomplished.
Thanks to my son, terribly close going, who weighs at least 10 feet without topping over, along the pathway that we had taped under the rough surface, my second objective accomplished. Next, the most difficult, what climbs into the Arctic Ocean, forbidden by the captain, but I don't understand Russian. The ship doctor forbids that I managed to get a passenger.
I protested too, as you recall.
That's right, I pretended I didn't.
assembly to celebrate the presence at the North Pole. A surprise for Ed, Chief Passenger Officer Bogdan, standing by Captain Andrei Smirnov, beckoned him with some insistence to join him at the microphone. A couple of days ago, he had asked several times how to spell Ed's name. Was there a passport or maybe a visa problem? On the contrary, the captain, with some appropriate comments in Russian, said that he was presenting Ed with Yamal's key to the North Pole. Made of bronze, it was beautiful. Ed's name was engraved on it and correctly spelled. He was requested to respond and kept it appropriately brief. Soon, the group broke up for various activities, but the wetsuit under his clothing hadn't warmed up much, so Ed was beginning to shiver. While others ate barbecue and consumed hot drinks, Ed Ball climbed up the 7 or 8 decks to his cabin, looked at us, and stood for about 15 minutes under a scalding hot jaw. With the blood now flowing once again, he dressed and returned to the ice. Most of the barbecue was gone, but his mission had been accomplished, and he didn't much care. There was a short baseball game on the ice and a dance around the Maypole. A North Pole, of course. There were countless opportunities for photographs. Reluctantly, everyone returned to their quarters, tired but pleased to have accomplished their various missions. Incidentally, 2 U.S. submarines surfaced while the Yamal was in the vicinity of the North Pole. Finally, the ship resumed crashing and grinding through the ice. It was 2 days now to their next destination, Novaya Zemlya Island, then through the Kola Sea and back to Murmansk. Dinner, as usual, was at 7:30, still broad daylight, of course. A lecture about polar bears and other furry creatures was lightly attended. Most were too tired. That night, the cabin video, appropriately, was Across the Top of the World. Then it was to bed. The time of arrival at the magnificent glacier at the north tip of Novaya Zemlya Island was 3:30 in the morning. Still broad daylight, of course. No one stayed in bed. Same as Ed would be in Iraq, the captain put the nose of his vessel within a few feet of the glacier. No tower ever had. Without the ice on the ship's floor, the hard moves of the more spectacular caverns. Beautiful sight. By GPS, Muncie was now further away than at the North Pole. 3,767 nautical miles. Reluctantly, passengers returned to bed for a few hours' sleep before the next day's activities. Although their objective, the North Pole, had been achieved, there was more to see and do. Novaya Zemlya Island off the coast of Siberia is the farthest reef outcrop in the Ural Mountains. Here, 400 years ago, Russian Wilhelm Barents formed the sea as named Winter with 12 men. Wooden crosses mark the site. 2 men died here. Barents himself did not make it home. Hansen's base camp was established here in 1865 for further exploration northward. Personally conducted tours of the 3 decks of Ushima were presided over by Yuri Akramkin, chief engineer. Earlier in his career, Akramkin had served on a Russian nuclear-powered submarine. A briefing in his suite was translated, interestingly and sometimes humorously, by Chief Passenger Officer Bogdan. Questions, serious and facetious, were answered frankly and with good humor. All were convinced that all was well with the mechanicals of this great ship, that Yuri knew every part of this massive mechanical monster, could identify every squeak and groan, and knew how to fix it if needed. The 3 decks of mechanicals were spotlessly clean, functioning under the watchful eyes of young engineers stationed at rows and banks of dials and gauges. And security of the nuclear system was emphasized, constantly monitored by 185 strategically located Geiger counters. It was a night and a day's sailing from the northern tip of Novaya Zemlya, south to Khabarovo, on the north coast of Siberia, one of Stalin's gulags. Here he sentenced for life intellectuals who felt dangerous to his communist society. sort of desert rover, explored and photographed its coastal interior. After ample opportunity to contemplate man's inhumanity to man, the helicopters returned passengers to the ship for the short voyage to Vigage Island, where they were fortunate enough to find a small group of the nomad Nenshti natives. Ed was given a ride in one of their reindeer-drawn sleighs. They seemed happy, healthy, and content with their simple life. Ed was invited into one of the tents formed of hides stretched over poles, much like the teepees of early Native Americans. It was dark inside, but a kerosene stove burned brightly, cooking a meal. The family consisted of a father, mother, three smiling children, probably 3 to 5 years old, and a baby in a cradle. They seemed as curious to see their visitor as he was to see them. And speaking of curiosities, yes, that is a rocket nose cone, you see. It fell out of the sky nearby. The crew returned to the ship with a reindeer butchered for the next evening's meal. It was an exchange for a number of items, tools, clothing, staple foods. Everyone was happy. By GPS, this was the furthest point recorded from Muncie, 4,031 nautical miles, much further than at the North Pole. And they had thought they were headed home. From Vigage Island, it was a couple of days straight sailing back to Murmansk, free, finally, of that rigid ice which had lost its charm. The remainder of the voyage was routine, a few concluding lectures. Disembarkation seemed almost too soon. The 15 days had gone quickly, filled with excitement, new experiences, new friends. It was hard to believe it was really over. No major problems. Bus to the airport and a Finnair flight to Helsinki. Miraculously, all baggage arrived at the hotel. A fine farewell dinner with shipmates, then an 8.5 hour flight to JFK. Appropriately for Captain McLaren, the in-flight movie was Periscope Up. Then it was through courteous and efficient customs to the shambles of JFK's transportation system, the worst experience of the trip. The news was full of the tragic loss 2 days before of Flight 800, all lives lost. Security seemed normal. Everyone hoped it was effective. Now we go to North Pole. Here to go so was the last return to North Pole and a dream of hope. We followed the passport explorers. We really hoped that their team had solved 6 million square miles of ice. It has sounded centuries of explorers and adventures. It challenged us.
It was just the ultimate. It was the top of the world. A fabulous adventure. We're glad we went and glad to have safely returned.